I'd like to welcome you to the next in our series of Global Health Perspectives podcasts. My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And we've been exploring issues on the nexus of smoking and global health. Today, I have a friend and colleague all the way from New Zealand, Marua Glover. Marua has a professional background in smoking and really, perhaps as critically for this talk, is one of the world leaders in thinking about smoking health and Indigenous people and their sovereignty. Let me start off, Marua, but really just asking you to talk through your professional journey in Public Health New Zealand and how you got to set up the Centre for Research Excellence on Indigenous Sovereignty and Smoking.
Oh, thank you, Derek. It's so wonderful to see you and talk with you. And I've got a bit of cabin fever. I haven't had a chance to talk with many people lately for several weeks now with lockdown here in New Zealand. And thank you very much for inviting me onto your podcast. I've really been enjoying the series. So I began in public health, it would be about 30 years ago. I actually began in Outback Victoria in Australia and working in a community health centre, managing a community health centre there. And we had at that time a smoking program just going into Australia, Quitline, which we were implementing in our local Outback Community Health Centre. So that was my first introduction to, I guess, the, you know, supports for helping people to stop smoking. And then I came back to New Zealand. I did my master's in social science. Most of my training is psychology, and I went on to do my PhD. So I'm a behavioural science scientist. I went to work for government to learn about how the government works and policy analysis. And that's really when I learned that smoking was our biggest killer, the biggest killer of New Zealanders altogether, but also for Māori and our Indigenous people here. And in Australia, it's a similar picture in America and Canada, and actually now I'm learning around the world that Indigenous people mostly have disproportionately high smoking rates. So I dedicated my career to learning how to reduce smoking for all people, but particularly among Indigenous people. I have worked in national coordination roles, rolling out programs about reducing smoking for Māori people. And then I went into research, and I've been doing that for basically 17 years. It was a fantastic opportunity to join you, Derek, and the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World, to have the opportunity to take that knowledge and expertise more broadly and internationally and be able to help other Indigenous people. And at World Conferences on Tobacco Health, where I first met you and have seen you across the years, there were very few Indigenous people from around the world that would pop up at those conferences. And no one ever stayed the course, if you know what I mean. You know, there would be people and then you would never see them again. And I noticed particularly there was a major problem with building capacity and capability. So that just wasn't happening across the world.
Yeah, just to maybe push on a bit more about that, Marua, I think one thing that I learned from you early is the fact that there's incredible stigma and vulnerability generally among Indigenous people, which means that not only do they have some of the highest smoking rates in the world, but there'd be other major risk factors for chronic diseases, including mental health. And it seemed like one of the challenges is how to deal with that complex set of factors where smoking is one of many major risks. I'd love your thoughts about how you tackle that and how you see we need to think about that, maybe not just for Indigenous people, but for other societies.
That's right. There's, I guess, one of the problems, and being trained in the Anglo-Western Academy, there's a It's based on a way of looking at the world and perceiving it and analyzing it. And it's incommensurate with the way that Indigenous people view the world from a more holistic systems theory perspective, I guess you would call it. So, you know, we tend to sort of look at the broader picture and then you focus in, but you can come back out again. So you see how everything is interdependent and related. So looking at smoking, you wouldn't just look at smoking on its own. You would understand why a person smokes. You would see the social and economic determinants and the familial triggers, everything that's happening, plus the historical causes, which are significant in terms of colonization, intergenerational trauma from that, the leftover effects that are passed on. And so it's that huge difference. It's not so huge now, because in the Anglo-Western Academy, there's a lot of thought around systems theory and thinking, and also Michael Marmot's work on the social and economic determinants of health have really helped to raise the awareness and understanding in that Anglo-Western Academy of those broader effects and impacts and determinants of health. So for Indigenous people, who, particularly those who were colonised or who have been marginalised in their own countries, there's significant trauma around that, and being sort of pushed down to the bottom of the ladder and left there, neglected, and deliberately so in some cases, that leads on to many of those health issues and mental health issues. Then you have the other institutional racism, where a health system is set up based on one culture and delivers effectively mostly to that culture. So our health systems need to adapt and serve their customers. So it's more tailored. You have culturally appropriate methods of working with people and interventions, and interventions need to be salient to that group. It needs to be acceptable to them. So, for example, you can't have a program that actually is breaching some or offensive to some cultural belief. So it's quite complex, but fascinating and wonderful work.
Yeah, and I know that we're going to see substantive progress there. Let me turn predictably to the fact that we are now in the midst of a pandemic. And I think we've all watched with interest how Prime Minister Ardern has been a true global leader in the way she seems to have focused on the right combination of science, empathy and politics to help you make the progress you are. But I would love you to really think a bit more about the work, the rationale for the work that you're looking at now, asking how are smokers coping in this lockdown, and what is the vision that you have for the importance of this work as you stretch it out, not just from New Zealand, but to the US?
Yes, that study we're doing, so we're running an online survey, it's totally anonymous, and focused on people who were already using psychoactive substances, so people who were smoking, drinking alcohol, who use other drugs, and who vape nicotine. The research on previous disasters, such as the 9/11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, or Hurricane Katrina, and here in New Zealand, the Christchurch earthquakes almost 10 years ago, research on the effects of those disasters on a population showed us that smoking and alcohol use and other drug use tends to go up either during the disaster, but also that lingers and prevalence stays elevated for up to a year. And of course, we know that the determinants of smoking, you know, stress is a huge trigger, grief, fear, anxiety, all of these, it's just natural to expect that these behaviours are going to increase at this time, that this has been an incredibly frightening time to see the coronavirus take off around the world as quickly as it did. The death rates in particularly those first places that were hit, and then there's been the wave going around the world, incredibly frightening for everybody. And so that's raising a lot of deep fear, anxiety, and of course, those of us who work in reducing smoking, straight away we're going to go, uh-oh, this is going to, you know, we're doing so well, we've got all these interventions, we're putting a lot of effort into how can we help people stop smoking altogether or switch to greatly risk-reduced alternatives, and hello, we have this pandemic, and it is tragic. And we just started talking about it, my team, and we were like, how are people going to cope? And then what happened was that some of the more incumbent tobacco control people who have been around for a long time, who tend to favour a prohibitionist approach, began to lobby their governments to ban tobacco during this time. So the governments were working out, well, what's an essential item that you'll still be able to buy? What shops do need to be open? And we saw vape shops shut here in New Zealand and in Italy initially, but as you know, you've talked with Ricardo and he was instrumental in having that reversed. And in South Africa, that was, I guess, one of the most shocking, where they banned the sale of tobacco and alcohol, I heard, for 6 months. And, well, we can see what's happening there with the looting of alcohol shops, people not complying with lockdown because they need to go out and find alcohol. If you deny people access to a product that they are physically dependent upon in a time of huge stress, and when they're going to be triggered to smoke more, drink more, yeah, it kind of was a double whammy. We felt this really needed to be investigated, and we hope to have very useful information to inform the health services going forward. You know, how are we going to help people heal from this and move on and build resiliency for the next time this happens?
Do you feel, Marua, that this is an opportunity, sort of a unique time really in world public health history, to reemphasize the importance of healthy behaviors, but to think of the messaging and the approaches with a greater degree of compassion and empathy than we have till now? And if so, what would that be? What would it look like?
I think we have reached a critical point, and that it's brought the attention of public health, well, into every lounge room, every home. People might not have really known what public health was before. And we're really talking about the basics of public health, infection control, what's happening now. This is what public health originally was all about, preventing the spread of disease, making sure people have clean water, making sure there's sufficient and effective sanitation. In New Zealand, and I think in other countries as well, over the last 30 years, there's been a shift in public health from focusing and prioritising those basics, especially in rich, developed nations where we had the sanitation, we've got clean water, we've got enforcement officers that go around and make sure that restaurants are not spreading, you know, Campylobacter and stuff. So we've got all of those bases covered, and public health has moved to focusing on behaviours called lifestyle behaviours, and I think that one of the shocking things is that the lack of preparedness in New Zealand and in many other countries when this pandemic began is partly because the priority in public health and the competition for funding in that sector, where you've got tobacco control constantly having to argue their case why they need funding at all, why they need more funding, and then you've got the people in the obesity sector doing the same. So we have these departments within public health that constantly compete with each other for funding. And I'd have to say that infection control, or really the funding that should have been going into preparing for a pandemic and what our response would be, that they've been, if they've had any funding at all, they've been a very poor cousin in it. And I think that this time, the responses of government, which have been very, very extreme to lock everyone away, not just the sick, given in the past, the many pandemics and plagues in history, quarantine was about isolating the sick from the well. And we've kind of done an opposite thing here of quarantining everybody. And unfortunately, you know, we have unemployment rising here in New Zealand. We're hearing of suicides. We already had a very high rate of suicide, and so that's very, very concerning. And if you think again about Marmot's ladder, there will be a lot of people who are being pushed down the rungs and to the bottom of the heap. And we will see, unfortunately, ongoing devastation. So it's been a very hard balance. And
yeah, and I think that, you know, we've unfortunately always seen the pendulum swing one way or the other. As you hinting at, that maybe in the post-COVID era, there'll be great pressure for the pendulum to swing towards a almost total focus on pandemic preparedness, infectious disease control, and then the complexity of lifestyle and behavioral change driving chronic diseases, which I always remind people are the biggest set of causes of death and disease going into the COVID-19 pandemic and will be the biggest emerging from it. They may be slightly displaced for a time, and I think it's going to be work like yours, particularly the work that will focus on how people who are already struggling are coping under the worst conditions of lockdown and the solutions we come out to deal with their concerns across the spectrum of psychoactive substances and other healthy lifestyles will be fundamental. I want to just thank you, Marua, for this opportunity to really give us some great insights. And I hope over the next few months we'll come back as we all emerge into the bright lights of hopefully a healthier, better world, and congratulate you on the work and the effort that you are putting into improving the health of people, particularly Indigenous people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Derek. It's been wonderful to talk with you about this very topical, very important topic.
Let me end off by saying that I hope that you all write to us about ideas and give your suggestions. And you can get hold of us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And please remember to stay safe and to remain positive and think of the opportunities for the future to make them a brighter future than today. Thank you.